for the sermon, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Pishoner. I neglected to tell Mr. Tannert that Danny Camp wanted to thank everyone for their prayers and thoughts on behalf of him and his surgery, and I asked him how he's doing, and he said, horrible. You can always depend on Danny for a totally upfront, blunt, honest answer. But he does appreciate it. He has been home, of course. He had outpatient surgery with vascular surgery, but he felt like he really needed to stay one more week at home and not be up and about. Of course, Mr. Tannert read the announcement about what is happening in society, and it's not something, obviously, it just happened all at once, and it's not something that probably surprised a lot of people. If you've been in the church for a long time, and probably not totally shocked by the Supreme Court's decision that they rendered. And you can almost guarantee that any further decisions that the Supreme Court makes, as long as the court maintains its current makeup, and barring a Republican election in 2016, there wouldn't be an opportunity to nominate more conservative justices who are not justices that would try to interpret law but just try to uphold the Constitution. So that's anybody's guess as to where that's going to happen, what it's going to do. But at the very best, with any decision that we might all be interested in, I'm pretty sure that all of us were really interested in this last decision that was made that gives a legal sanction to homosexual marriages and unions. The best that you could hope for with the present makeup of the court is a 5-4 decision in favor of something that we might agree with. And there are a plethora of things that will be brought up in lawsuits. But as things currently are, that's the best that we can hope for, because we know this, that the liberal minds do not ever deviate from one another, and whether they may disagree with one another or not, they will always uphold a liberal standpoint, and there are four solid, ultra, ultra-liberal justices on the Supreme Court, and they are the ones that were nominated so that they would get to this point and be able to actually write the law of the land. And it's really a shame. But for those of us that have been around for a long time, it's probably not a huge, big surprise. And it still kind of takes your breath away, and it is kind of shocking. And not only that, but other recent Supreme Court decisions. And here we are on the 4th of July celebrating our independence and our freedom as Americans. And we like to trump our freedoms. And sometimes those freedoms, taken to the extreme, where it's freedom from any kind of law, actually tend to enslave the individuals. But looking on the bright side, July 4th, 1776, 239 years ago, the Declaration of Independence was signed in Philadelphia by the framers of the Constitution, some of the most brilliant minds of the last 500 years. These men represented the original 13 colonies. So this is our day of independence from Britain, the day we declared independence from Britain. And one of the mitigating factors that caused all of that, as you know, was an incredibly high, exponentially higher than ever normal before tax that was imposed on the colonies on tea of 4%. 4%. How many people would like to pay 4% of tax on anything these days? Raise your hands. I'll take that deal any day of the week. There was a different mindset that they had, a different attitude. And you have to understand, in understanding our history, you have to get back and you have to understand how brave these individuals were. They gave up virtually everything by signing their names to that piece of paper. They could have been hung for treason by the King of England. Incredible men, and we owe a lot to them, but we owe a lot more to God, because we know that God is the one that paved the way for all of this to happen. The second sentence in the Declaration of Independence is one of the most famous phrases in all of the English language, and I'll quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I can see a lot of you are just kind of mouthing along the words. You know those phrases. It's one of the most famous of all in the English language. In throwing off the yoke of English rule, the American colonies not only sought freedom for themselves, but they served as a model for nations all around the world for the next 200 years. There are many, many other groups of people that look to the Declaration of Independence and later on the Constitution as it was ratified in 1787 as a model for them. And then slowly but surely the age of colonialism was over and other peoples declared their independence from the nations that they had been either founded by or taken over by. America, the idea of America, inspired people and has been an inspiration of people who seek their independence from overbearing rule. And of course, in 1787, the Constitution of the United States was ratified, no mean feat, writing the Federalist Papers, which were a precursor to the Constitution, and then the Constitution was adopted by all 13 colonies. And those documents helped prepare the way for the greatest ascendancy of power in the greatest nation that has ever been in the history of mankind. There were those initial steps, and it wasn't always easy going, of course. It was with the threat of death, as I mentioned. It was with a lot of strong wills in the same room at one time in steamy July in Philadelphia in 1776, and it finally came together. So today, as Americans, we celebrate our freedom, and some of you probably watch, at least from afar, the fireworks displays. A lot of people forget, you know, just like they do at Thanksgiving, a national holiday, that we're supposed to remember our Creator. A lot of people forget about what really happened and the hard work that it took to overcome the resistance to the revolution itself, because there were a lot of colonists that really didn't have any problem with the King of England. They're kind of separated by an ocean. You know, it took a while for individual people to be persuaded, and it was the grab for more and more power that finally convinced the majority of colonists that we needed to do this. And it were the men who were the leaders, the Jeffersons, the Adams, the Franklins, Washingtons, and all the rest, who finally were able to come together as the representatives of their individual states and bring this into a binding union. What is happening to the land of the free and the home of the brave? It depends on who you ask, I guess. The pervasive drumbeat of liberalism and Democrat Party and the news media is overwhelmingly a liberal message. Continually, it is overbearing, and some people like it because they're liberally minded. They love the changes, and they love the fact that these changes are happening. They don't understand, really, what the future holds. But I always kind of look to, maybe it's kind of stuck within my bringing up, because I was almost born into this rebellious age, like some of the rest of you, brought up in this rebellious age, kind of always felt myself distanced from it as I was growing up and, you know, living in the 50s, and that, you know, I mean, there weren't any rebellions there. There weren't any revolutions that were taking place at that time. But the 60s was certainly a time of revolutionary thought in our country. And the terminology was coined back in the late 60s, the silent majority. Those are the people that really hated what was going on in society, the degradation of society, which was beginning then. And a lot of historians trace the problems that we have today back that particular time. I had my generation of baby boomers, maybe 40%, 50% of them turning rebellious, being angry at the government, being angry at this and that. And I didn't ever feel like I was a part of that particular group. I always felt like our parents had instilled within us the love of country. My dad had been a veteran of Normandy invasion of Europe, and although he didn't really talk about it, the values that you learn while you're in a family are just kind of passed by osmosis to you, and you kind of adopt those things as your own. So I always felt as though maybe, even though at one time I've had to repent of this, in the 10th and 11th grade, I was part of the Young Democrat Party in our high school and everything, so I had to kind of have a mind cleansing over that whole process. But back then, it was a totally different party. It wasn't the Democrats of today. And maybe in the Deep South, there are still some leftover Reagan Democrats who are basically conservatives who have, for whatever reason, aligned with the Democrat Party. But back in those days, there were a lot of elements of the Democrat Party that were far more conservative than they are today, that is for sure. You know, there was the kind of Hubert Humphrey Democrats who were considered the far left of that day and age. George McGovern, again, the far left of that age. They would be considered right of Ronald Reagan today with their views and viewpoints. Well, maybe not quite that, but they'd certainly be right center. They wouldn't be on the far left, but they were the far left, extreme left of the Democrat Party at that particular time, at least the ones that were in power. So what is happening? Well, the Supreme Court decision is one aspect of what is happening, changing values, changing attitudes. I don't know. It's just my opinion. I still kind of think that it's not in the majority yet. But the biggest demographic in our country in terms of generation are the young people ages 34 and under. And to them, everything is about fairness and equality. They haven't been taught about right and wrong. They've been taught about fairness and equality. And so to that mindset, to those individuals who've been brought up in that, a Supreme Court ruling like this seems, to many of them, I'm sure, a very natural and accepting thing. Because they have no counterpoint, they have no teaching, they have no structure of values. Yeah, sure, I went to a pagan church when I was a little kid, but we taught, at least in Sunday school when I was there, the Ten Commandments were taught, and we had to memorize them. We had to learn about them. You know, later on when I was confirmed in the Lutheran church, we really didn't ever talk about the law of God. But when I was a little kid, growing up in the 50s, the Ten Commandments were things that we believed in and understood and were broadcast. And all of my friends in elementary school, they didn't all go to the Lutheran church in Sunday school. They went to the Catholic church, and they went to the Episcopalian church and the Methodist church, which was right next door to the Lutheran church. And we all basically had the same lessons. Lessons of based on the law of God. So what is happening to us in this land of the free and the home of the brave, at a time when America looks back on its proud heritage of freedom, it's appropriate for us to look at the only possible guidepost for the future. Because you can't look back on our past and predict what is going to happen in the future, at least from this perspective. As Americans, we have only known blessing. Blessing, 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 blessing. You know, a few hiccups along the way, Korean War, Vietnam War, Middle East problems of the last 15 years or so. We have only remembered as individuals growing up in this country that times were getting better and better and better and better. Maybe with the exception of the past few years, things kind of going backwards a little bit. Still, most of us are pretty well fed. But George Santayana, the Spanish slash American philosopher said this, and it's often been misquoted, and it's often been attributed to others, but he's the one that originally said this: "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. But our American past does not really give us a great guidepost to the future." It really doesn't. We have to go to the Bible to see what's going to happen to us. In Hosea chapter 1, you'll remember that the book of Hosea begins in kind of a very weird way, because this prophet is told to do something that we would consider to be very repulsive and very wrong. But he was commanded by God to do this. That is Hosea, written probably 100 or so years, 120 years prior to the captivity of the 10 nations of Israel, the northern kingdom, as we would call it. "The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Abaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, the king of Israel." So through a number of the kings of Israel and Judah, that's when Hosea lived. "When the Lord began to speak by Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, 'Go take yourself a wife of harlotry, a prostitute, and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord.'" Now, did they have Supreme Court decisions in the 10 nations of Israel that decreed that, you know, some of the things that we've had decreed, that there wouldn't be school prayer in the local synagogue in the capital city of Samaria? Probably not. They had other things that were going on, but they were departing from God. And just as we did in 1963 decision, I always gave Madeline Murray O'Hare the credit for eliminating prayer from the schools, but she was only one voice. The original case was a case that took place in 1958 in New York State, and it was started by a Jewish fellow that didn't want his daughter praying in the public school. And then seven other families joined, and it eventually got to the Supreme Court, and it was decided in 1962 and 63 that we would have school prayer. Schools would not begin with prayer. So this has changed, obviously, if people are in private school where they allow such things. But in public schools, public prayer was cast aside. And not that, you know, saying the Lord's Prayer was the only thing that would keep people on a straight and narrow. Obviously, doing something by rote is not necessarily going to make you the most obedient person in the world, but it was the elimination of God, and it was the arguments that followed that really weren't realistic, but they've become a part of, and I'll get to those in a minute, they have become such a part of our lore that they almost become factual. Say if you repeat something three times, it's a lie, it becomes a fact. And in our country today, that's what we see happening. You repeat something long enough, and that's the way it is. It doesn't matter what the reality is. That's what happens. So Hosea, anciently, God speaking to him, Israel, 10 tribes, a bunch of people, millions of people, and so he is told to take this wife as a prostitute because it's a type of the relationship that he has with the nation of Israel, because Israel has become a prostitute as well. And so they had these children as a result of their marriage. Verse 10 says, "Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And it shall come to pass in a place where it was said to them, 'You are not my people,' there it shall be said to them, 'You are the sons of the living God.'" The book of Hosea details prophecies against Israel. We're not going to go through the book today. I think we've done that in the past. I think Mr. Tandert has done that. I have done that. You can read it. It's a very captivating book of prophecy, speaking specifically of the punishments and the problems of Israel and the things that Israel is guilty of and how Israel has departed from God. And obviously, we can do and we can cite survey after survey, and we can show you the slow degradation of the belief in God in our society. For once, it was in the 50s when I was a little kid. The belief in God was probably 85% of the population. Now it might be in the 60s if we're lucky. But it continually erodes. So removing prayer from the public schools didn't necessarily, even by itself, lead to a wholesale rejection of God, but it was a step. It was a first step. And one thing that we know about our system is that we are great at precedents, right? You have a precedent set here, and so that precedent is used to base another law and another change, another interpretation of the law later on. And finally, it just breaks down over a period of time, and that has led to less and less belief in God and less teaching of the Word of God. 100 years ago, 150 years ago, as Alexis de Tocqueville said, as a French philosopher visiting in the 1820s in America, that the churches, no matter what they were in the United States, were filled with preachers who taught about the Bible. And you can go back and talk to your grandparents, and you'll find that most of the time when they went to church, it doesn't matter that there was not a Sabbath-keeping church, they went to churches and God's law was expounded upon all the way back to the beginnings of our country. And it's only been in the recent generation or so that churches don't really teach the law of God actively anymore. The American past is one triumph followed by another triumph, one blessing followed by multiple blessings, followed by increased blessings, followed by just incredible expansion of power and blessing. There's got to be a reason for that other than just government and a constitution and a declaration of independence. Those things certainly helped, and I believe that they were inspired, those individuals, framers of the Constitution, certainly they were inspired because much of their teaching was founded on reading the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament. And then they read a lot of other things, and they were very learned individuals. But the American past is not necessarily a clear guideline for the future, because for years and years, many of us have just lived in ever-increasing prosperity. Some retreats every so often, Great Depression here, you know, maybe 2009, another mini depression and problems and that sort of thing. But we have known the greatest prosperity of any peoples, and we can be thankful for that. At least we can be one group, and maybe there are a lot of other groups that can be thankful for that. But we can recognize that God is the one that provided all of that and provided all of the opportunity for us. Now, the very beginning of the Declaration of Independence is either ignored or disregarded altogether in the modern world, and I'll address what I think one of the roots of that disregard is in just a minute. But here is how the Declaration of Independence began. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for the people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with one another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. And then led to that second sentence of the Declaration of Independence, which I said is one of the most famous phrases in all of human history, and certainly in the English language, the belief that all men are created equal, and the belief that all men have the right to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Where did these men get that crazy cockamamie idea? Where did they get it? From whence did they derive that? Where did they get this idea that they could cite nature's God as the one that provided them the rights as individual citizens and to separate themselves from an oppressive king, King George III? The separation which the colonists sought was a freedom from the whimsical and the imperious nature of a monarch, which they realized was wrong. But for centuries heretofore, kings were thought to derive their power from God. And even in many cases, as in the case of the Catholic Church, it was felt that there was this concordant with church and state to where the Pope would bless the king, and the king derived his right from the church and actually ruled as a part of the church over the subjects of whichever nation. Obviously, the power of kings did come from God. Yes, that's right. We read Romans 12, and we know that those powers are allowed by God on this earth, and God has allowed things to happen on this earth. So ultimately, the power did come from God, but that doesn't mean that the king ever ruled or the kings ruled in a godly fashion. You might be able to find a handful through history of monarchs who ruled with the beneficence of their subjects in mind. And what king have you ever known, even in Israel or Judah, what king actually obeyed the instruction, and you know where I'm going with this, Deuteronomy 17 and verse 18. What king can you point to in the Old Testament that it is recorded that they actually did this? Well, I'm going to tell you, exactly none. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean no one ever did it? I have no way of telling. We just don't have any proof that it was there. There's just an absence of evidence. And I know that an absence of evidence doesn't equate to an evidence of absence. Think about it. However, we don't see any example that I know of the king actually writing out. It was almost as if by the time that the re-giving of the law came about in Deuteronomy, meaning repeat, Deutero meaning repeat, just before they entered into the land, that it was kind of a fait accompli that eventually Israel would cry out to have a king. It was kind of a given at that point because God didn't give them a king to begin with. That only happened when the elders came to Samuel, right, and said, your sons are sinning, and the elimination of the judges period was finally over at that particular time. And what did Samuel do? He warned them. We'll get back to that in just a little bit. But he told them what would happen to them as a society. Things would change, and there would be a fundamental change from which there has never been any going back since that time. Hang with me. I'll get to that in a minute. I don't want to get ahead of myself. It shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites. I don't know of anybody that's ever done that. Now, if there is, man, more power to them. But just the very act of writing out the law, thinking about it, writing about it, having to put it in your own handwriting, helps impress those commands on the minds of the individual. We don't know that it was never done, but we don't know that it was done. But we do know that you can't find many, if any, I don't think of any, secular kings throughout the history of mankind that actually did something similar to this. And so the American experience was one of rebelling against a king that wouldn't operate under laws. It was whatever the king wanted to do became law. Whatever the king decreed, he wasn't bound by strictures such as law himself. He was above the law. And the colonists and these men, Adams, Jefferson, Mason, all the rest of them, Hancock, began to realize that. And they coalesced on July 4th, 1776, after apparently Jefferson had labored over this document for several days, kind of closeted up in a home in Philadelphia and submitted his, you know, he felt that Adams should wrote it. Adams felt that he should be the one that wrote that document, the Declaration of Independence. And then they made a number of revisions, kept most of his copy intact. And then that was printed, and it was made available throughout the colonies. Copies were sent to England, and the fight was on. And, of course, we're already in the fight with the with the Continental, or with the Continental Army, and George Washington was the general. We were already in the fight with the British, and we declared our independence after the warring had already begun. But that revolution not only transformed America, guess what? It transformed, and it turned out to be a good thing for Great Britain as well. It actually turned out to be a blessing in disguise for Great Britain, because after the war was over, and after the Declaration, and then after the Constitution was adopted, and we were officially recognized as a separate nation, then the British were free to concentrate on other areas of the world. They still had Canada, they still had vast portions of Africa, and then they were able to go to India and the Far East and all of these other points around the globe, and they were able to develop and to colonize. And you can't tell me that the British Empire didn't do a lot of good in a lot of different places, despite what the history of revisionists have said. But unencumbered by an American Revolution now, Great Britain became a commonwealth of nations, the likes of which the world had never seen before, nor is not certainly not duplicated within the United States either. It's a separate and different kind of magnificence. But incredibly, because of that revolution, both of these groups of people were able to blossom and grow throughout the 19th century and continue through the 20th century and to provide for the entire world, and I know I've said this before, so I hate to sound like a broken record, but bears repeating, that they provided salvation for mankind on several fronts in the early part of the 20th century, in the mid part of the 20th century. So they may have lost 13 colonies in America, and a lot of biblical historians and prophetic biblical historians kind of look at what happened with the emigration of people from England specifically to the United States, or other countries that contributed to the immigration of America originally, but basically it was Great Britain. So you have this emigration of peoples from Great Britain because they were being threatened with hanging in many cases because they could not express themselves in their religion the way they wanted to. That's why they wanted to come here, the Pilgrims. That's why they wanted to come here, the Puritans, the same way. They wanted to come here because of religious freedom, the ability to express themselves in a way differently than the Church of England decreed. And so they did. And they came over here in droves. And the country grew. Interestingly, after that emigration, that great transformation of people to this country, civil wars in Great Britain stopped. They didn't have any more War of the Roses or Hundred Years' War. Civil war ceased in Great Britain at that time. And then 87 years or so after our founding, we had a civil war. You know, those people, those groups of people, somehow or another, the genealogical makeup of those people, I believe, remained. So we had to heal that fraction or that faction over the course of time, and we did. But it actually the revolution never diminished the role of Britain in Europe. Britain was then able to repel two separate invasions by France. They were able to finally defeat Napoleon. As Margaret Thatcher has said, Europe has only been united in tyranny. And that was the goal, and that was the makeup of Napoleon. That's what he wanted. And the British were able to thwart that particular problem so that there wouldn't be that dominant power. The British never tried to exert their influence to a great degree to rule over all the rest of the continent, but they certainly helped keep the continent in check with the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo. While the American experiment, the rights of the individual citizen, were being realized throughout the 19th century, however imperfect it was, because for the first 65 years, slavery was still legal within the United States, in Europe, other aspects of governance were brewing. In 1818, the father of modern socialism and communism, Karl Marx, was born. He lived most of his life in London, and he was a prolific writer about social theory and economics and politics, and he was an atheist. And Marx, despite our differences of opinion with Marxist theory and communism, we must agree that he was one of the most influential of all human beings during the 19th century. It was after his death that many of his ideas were implemented by a number of different societies and governments. The birth of modern socialism is traced back. Communism certainly traced back to Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. The ideas of the entitlements of our modern civilization go back to socialism and so on and so forth. They were a product of the 19th and the 20th century, but they are traced back to Marx. And that was a competing ideology with the idea of democracy. And the notion in the United States that every man could advance himself within the framework of law and the protection of the individual against an oppressive government or monarch, that took hold in America, but in other parts of the world, the influence of this philosopher, who died virtually penniless, by the way, began to take hold. Interestingly enough, if you watch the news, the birthplace of democratic thought, going back thousands of years to Greece, is today a failed nation, because as a socialist nation as it became, and sometimes a communist nation, as Margaret Thatcher once said, socialism is a great idea until you run out of other people's money. One nation was guided by the ideas and the thoughts that were biblically based, and much of the rest of the world has adopted the ideas of an atheist, and each have had a profound effect on mankind in the last 200 years. Now, in the introduction, I mentioned one of the most famous sentences from the Declaration of Independence: confirms the right of all men to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Where did this come from? Where did this idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of, where did liberty come from? People hadn't really ever experienced liberty like we experience liberty in America. It just wasn't a possibility elsewhere. One of Jefferson's favorite thinkers was an English philosopher by the name of John Locke. John Locke wrote two treatises on government, and he was an English philosopher, and he wrote that the idea that a person's right to live a healthy life and free to amass and maintain property, or life, health, liberty, and property, is one granted by God. Now, there was a time in Britain, in Great Britain, when many of their people believed in God. And you may have to go back several hundred years. They had people going to churches, and they had people, you know, after the time of the Revolution, they had people that believed in God, and England was the first modern country to abolish slavery. An excellent article that we had in the Good News magazine about 4 or 5 years ago brought that out. What was his name? William Oglethorpe. Isn't it Oglethorpe? Isn't it the one? Somebody will look it up on their device and tell me. But anyway, he was an individual that agitated for that particular abolishment, and in many parts of the northern United States, slavery was abolished, and then finally, through the genius of Abraham Lincoln, this vile practice was eliminated, and of course, the remnants and the problems still exist today. But George Mason, who is one of the founding fathers from Virginia, a month before the Second Continental Congress, wrote in the Virginia Declaration of Rights that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights of which they may enter into a state of society. They cannot by any compact deprive or divest their posterity, namely the enjoyment of life and liberty with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. A lot of these writers were influenced by Locke's writings. The origin of these ideas was the protection of individual rights and property from the state or from a sovereign who would determine that, oh, I like that piece of land over there. That's going to be mine because you know what? I am the king and I will do whatever I please. And that's the way many societies were governed. Mankind rebelled. The quest of mankind is to be free, to have liberty. But we have to be taught what that means, because otherwise we'll be enslaved to the wrong ideas and the wrong philosophies, as much of the world has been enslaved to a communist or a socialist ideology, which is far worse than a democratic philosophy, because at least the democratic philosophy holds that there's something special about that individual. The origin of these ideas was that we as a person would be protected because we had rights that were granted by nature, in other words, by God, and they could not be removed by a government or a king. Very similar to the comment that Mr. Tannert read, government, you can make any ruling you want to. You can do whatever you want, but we look to God and we determine that God has told us to do this, so we will not do that, even though you say so. So where did the thoughts and expressions of these great thinkers of the 17th and 18th century come from? They came from the Bible. These individuals were, if anything, they were taught from the Bible. That was the main teaching tool for reading and writing, was the Bible, first and foremost. It wasn't banned yet in England. It wasn't banned from the schoolroom in the United States at that particular time. But notice, where'd they get these ideas? They just dreamt them up themselves? No. They come from the Bible. Take a look at Leviticus chapter 25. Now, you have to kind of, as we go through this, you have to kind of put yourself in the time. You have to understand what God granted to Israel, and you have to get rid of any politically correct, idiotic thought about life of the 21st century, or how abhorrent this may sound to your little tender ears at this particular time in reading this chapter, because it can be easily misconstrued. I hope to shed some light on it, and I hope to help for those that would be opposed to reading, oh, what does that mean, or just be confused, that we can shed some light on this particular, on some of the things that are written here. In Leviticus chapter 25 and in verses 1 through 7, it talks about the nation keeping a sabbatical year, a nation in which all of the principles and all of the citizens understood that the land belonged to God and that God would provide for them as long as they obeyed God, and they would allow their land to lie fallow on that seventh year. And he promised a blessing in the sixth year that would last them through the seventh year and the eighth year up until the ninth year, so that they could get things going again and have a harvest after planting again. We have not enforced this ever in the Church of God, because we are not a nation. And I know that some very well-meaning people have kept the land Sabbath as farmers. We don't have too many farmers around nowadays, but we've had, when I lived in South Dakota, we had some farmers there. We had at least one farmer who had a fairly large ranch, and he would try to keep, he couldn't keep all of it fallow because he didn't own it. The bank owned a lot of it, but he tried to keep a seventh of it fallow every year. He wouldn't plant on it, and he tried his best, but it wasn't required of him. He just did it to try to do it. And as far as I know, he was usually a pretty good farmer. He's a rancher as well, so he did okay. Anyway, the church does not enforce this upon individuals. Individuals who own the land, they're free to do it if they wish. But it's not a stricture that the church has said, oh, wow, you're a farmer, you better let your land lie fallow. Wait a minute, the person doesn't even own the land. He's got a huge mortgage payment, and he has to do this. So it's not a practical thing. This is a law for a nation to keep, and it will be enforced at some time in the future after Christ's return. But interestingly, not only is it a chapter about the land Sabbath, but it's also a chapter about the Jubilee year. In verse 8, it says, "You shall count seven Sabbaths of years for yourself, seven times 7 years, and the time of seven Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a Jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possession." What did that mean? They would go back home. They would go back to their ancestral lands. In my case, I've got to go back to the area around Loch Lomond, Scotland. I'll see you later. I'm going up. I'm not going to stay there for the winter, though. It's brutal. Well, actually, that's where the Clan Buchanan was from. So I guess if I were going to follow this directive, don't think they'd accept me there anymore. But anyway, that's, I guess, where our clan was. Anyway, "That 50th year shall be a jubilee to you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine. For it is the jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its produce from the field. In this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his possession." You can see a lot about the rights of the individual and what God conferred to individuals, and not just individuals, but families, to protect them as a society. So they could buy and sell, but there were rules of the land that would govern that buying and selling. I'm not going to get too lost in the weeds or dig too deep into this, but just, you know, just as we read through here, you had the ability to sell land if you owned land. So I own 100 acres, and I need some money because I want to spend it on something else, so I can sell the land. And I'm limited, as you'll read through here, I am limited to a fair price for that land. I'm limited to obtain a fair price for that land, and the fair price of that land is the value of what that land would produce on an annual basis. And so however that was converted from crops to money, whatever the currency is, silver, gold, whatever it was of the day, that is what that was the limitation of the day. So if there were 40 years until the next Jubilee, the value of that land could be sold for the value of 40 harvests. Does that make sense? That's what it was limited to. There wasn't any wild speculation and appreciations and then depreciations. It was known quantity. But you could only buy that land, and there were certain provisions. There were certain other things we won't go into, the walled cities, buying homes in walled cities. You got to keep that forever if it was sold. But if it was just land, if that land was in your family, you could sell it. But the purchaser was limited to the extent of how many years were left to the Jubilee. And then all of that went back to the original family. And that's what it means. Well, those could go back to their lands. They would go back to their possessions. So it wasn't wrong to buy and sell land. And there would probably be some good reasons. You know, somebody might have a bad harvest 1 year, or they might have some misfortune, or they might have a death in the family. They might have the limited numbers of sons in the family, for instance. I'm just kind of making this up as I go along. Ideas are popping into my head. But if that individual who's the head of the household died and there was nobody else there to farm the land, the family would be able to get the appropriate value to take them all the way through to the time of the next Jubilee, and then it would come back, and by that time maybe other members of the family could redeem it. There were laws regarding the redemption of that, and they're spelled out here. To us, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, because when we buy land today, it's ours. I mean, but God said clearly in this chapter that you're not a permanent owner. You're not going to have it. I am the one that owns the land. I'm giving it to you. And that was God's to do. So verse 23, It says, "The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the land, your possessions, you shall grant redemption of the land. And if one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and if his redeeming relative comes to redeem it," and we have at least some biblical proof that these laws were obeyed through the time of the judges at least, because Boaz is one that was able to redeem Ruth. Remember, he was able because there was a near relative that couldn't redeem. He had other obligations. And then the next nearest relative was Boaz, and he was able to take Ruth as his wife. And it shows clearly that at least during some point of the judges, and perhaps even all the way through the time of the judges, the law of the Jubilee, land Sabbath, were kept. And we don't know for sure because they don't distill all the, they don't record all of those things that happened through the time of the judges. You know, the time of the judges was up and down and up and down. But at least we see the example of this occurring throughout that time. And as proof, I offer you the book of Ruth to read. So where it gets a little bit more difficult for our 20th and 21st century minds to understand is in the area a little bit further along in the chapter. I've already said, or at least implied, that one of the greatest pocks on our history was slavery. Obviously, one of the horrid things that was a part of all of mankind, and finally, again, as I said, thanks to the genius of Abraham Lincoln, at least an emancipation proclamation was made. The servitude that is mentioned in this chapter bears no resemblance. It cannot bear any resemblance to the kind of enslavement that mankind has put others to throughout his history and still does today. And it's spelled out very, very clearly in this chapter that there would be no toleration of abusiveness towards another human being, whether that individual was of Israel or whether that individual was from a foreigner from another land. There were laws prohibiting it. There are laws right here that prohibit it. There is servitude, and it's called slavery here. And, you know, a lot of us can certainly relate to that because we work for employers. And have you ever said of your boss, "Oh, that guy's a slave master. Wow." Well, that's what we're talking about. Employment. Basically, there was a lot of freedom designated for individuals, but say if somebody became, you know, it says in verse 39, "If one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. As a hired servant, as a sojourner, he shall be with you and shall serve you until the year of the Jubilee." Then he's released. He's an employee. He's working for an employer. Not a bad gig. Most of us have to do that. Unless you own your own business, and then you find out that you work for everybody else. When you own your own business, you find out that you're pretty much in servitude to all of your customers and to their whims and fancies and ideas. Verse 41, "And he shall depart from you, he and his children with him, and return to his own family. He shall return to the possession of his fathers. For they are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt, and they shall not be sold as slaves. You shall not rule over him with rigor, but you shall fear your God." The instruction was, look, hostility towards another human being is not going to be tolerated. "And as for your male and female slaves whom you may have from the nations that are around you, from them you may buy male and female slaves." And I'm sorry it's called slaves. I'm sorry it's wrong. I mean, it's a terminology. I mean, it could probably be a better word for it based on our tradition and our understanding of what that means in our culture and what that means to our minds. But they also were not to treat these individuals with rigors from the nations around them. You may take them, verse 46, as an inheritance for your children after you, to inherit them as a possession. They shall be your permanent slaves, but regarding your brethren and children of Israel, you shall not rule over one another with rigor. Now, if a sojourner or a stranger close to you becomes rich, and one of your brethren who dwells by him becomes poor and sells himself to the stranger or sojourner close to you, or to a member of the stranger's family, after he is sold, he may be redeemed again. One of his brothers may redeem him. And then we go through the rites of redemption. Mankind uses the Bible to justify a lot of his wrong actions, and anyone that would use the Bible in this to justify slavery in the United States, Great Britain, or anywhere else on the earth is crazy, is just totally crazy, because it does not sanction the ill treatment of other human beings. So the land was protected under the Jubilee, and its value, if sold, was only what it could produce for the limited time of the sale, and then it would return to the original owner. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, Moses uttered a startling prophecy. Deuteronomy 32. Now, before I comment on this in Deuteronomy 32, why don't we see much evidence of the land Sabbath and the Jubilee year after the time of Samuel, or after the time of the judges? Well, I don't have time to go there, but if you'll do a study of the time in which the elders of Israel came to Samuel and demanded a king, you'll see that Samuel gave them a warning that the king is going to do this. He's going to demand this and this. He's going to demand fields. He's going to be the owner of them all. In other words, he's going to exact tribute from you. You're going to supply your sons and daughters for his army, for his bakeries, for all of this. And it's my belief that there is no evidence given in the Bible of Israel obeying these laws regarding the Sabbath, because all of that was out the window once they adopted a king. Because the king had the ability, and they did oftentimes just take what they needed for themselves. Now, we had, of course, the unrighteous ruler ruling of Saul, and then we had the somewhat beneficent rulership of David and of Solomon, and then after that, it's a mixed bag throughout the rest of their history. That's a personal expression. And so probably that's why it was nothing more than just something recorded in the Bible afterwards. That's my opinion. In Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8, actually, Deuteronomy 32 is a prophecy of Israel and about the people of Israel and the descendants of Israel, what would happen to them. And in verse 8 it says, when the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. What? When the sons of Adam were separated from the beginning, the sons of Adam, we go back to Genesis 10 to see the sons of Adam. They are separated by God, and the boundaries of their habitation are set by God for all peoples, according to the number of the children of Israel. Jacob is the place of his inheritance. This ends the controversy once and for all about the nation of Israel. Well, not quite. God said that the boundaries of all the nations would be set according to the number of the children of Israel. And in Genesis 10, hold your place there. Let's go back to Genesis 10. Look what happened. In Genesis 10, you've got Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and then you've got their descendants that are listed. And then you got in verse 10, you've got the beginning of the kingdom of Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, and the land of Shinar. You know, that's the area of Assyria, and the area of to the west, or to the east, pardon me, of Jerusalem, where Iraq and Iran are. But notice this in verse 15. Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, the Jebusite, the Amorite, the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, and the Siddite, the Arvorite, and the Zemarite, and the Hamathite. Those are all the tribes of Canaan. 11 tribes of Canaan, along with Canaan himself, were given this habitation of the land of Canaan until Israel would come into being. They were there just renting the land too, until God said, you go in there, take possession of your land, and I'll drive them out, you know, with wasps or bees or whatever it says. I'll drive them out. That was the land that was given to them. This is a startling proclamation that the boundaries of the nation were set by the number of Israel. It was God's to do, just like he said in the Leviticus 25, that the land was his. They were just allowed to be there for a period of time, to be caretakers of land until Israel would come upon the scene. Chapter 32 of Deuteronomy in verse 10, he found him in a desert land, and in the wasteland, a howling wilderness, he encircled him, he instructed him, and he kept him as the apple of his eye, as an eagle stirs up its nest, hovers over its young, spreading out its wings and taking them up, carrying them on its wings. So the Lord alone led him, and there was no foreign God with him. He made him ride in the heights of the earth, that he might eat the produce of the fields, and it made him draw honey from the rock and oil from the flinty rock. And so Israel was blessed, and the only other nation that in modern times has been as blessed and claims God as its creator goes all the way back to the Pilgrims and the Puritans and the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Matthew Henry says, the Canaanites thought they had as good and sure a title to their land as any of their neighbors had to theirs, but God intended that they should only be tenants till the Israelites, their landlords, came. Thus God serves his own purposes of kindness to his people by those that neither know him nor love him, who mean not so, neither does their heart think so. The United States of America is, as we all know, unique. I don't care what any leader says. It's unique in its history. It's unique in its origin. It is special. We are the descendants of these people of Israel, but things are not so great in Israel today. Even as Hosea was told in ancient Israel to take a wife of harlotry, we have departed slowly but surely away from the living God in our society, in our institutions. There are still some, but there are a lot of people that are not real happy about it. Not real happy about that departure. Not very happy at all whenever some judge declares that the Ten Commandments are going to be removed from a courthouse somewhere. There are a lot of people that are upset. We're not the only people of faith. We know the Sabbath. We know the holy days. We really feel that obviously we are special because God has revealed a lot of things to us. But there are a lot of people that believe like you and I. Now, whether they're in the majority or not, we don't know yet. In 1962, I mentioned the banning of prayer in school. 72, the legalization of abortion. The entire population of the Deep South has been killed in the last 40 years. You know, think about that. The entire population, except for Florida, the entire population of the Deep South has been killed before they were ever born. It's amazing. 50 million people killed. It's just an incredible statistic when you think about, you know, that's the greatest tragedy, I think, maybe in the history of mankind. Now, some of the ideals which are expressed in our world today are very influential, yet they have no basis in any fact whatsoever, but the lies have been repeated often enough. There is this philosophy that you should know the difference in this. You should understand the difference. There's this idea and philosophy of a separation of church and state. When anything comes up about religion in government, Somebody says, separation of church and state, nah. Where did the idea of separation of church and state actually come from? A lot of people think that it's part of the Constitution. Oh, yeah, it's... What article is that? Let's see. There's nothing there that says anything about separation of church and state. Oh, wait a minute. What does the First Amendment to the Constitution actually say? Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. There's no mention of any wall or separation between church or state at all. So you should know that. I mean, it may save you someday. It may be something that you can rely on. But going back into our somewhat less than ancient history in the United States, there is a principle, and this one is usually cited to the separation of church and state is actually one of the things that is cited as a reason to drive religion from the public life and public discourse. And the ultimate objective of the liberal mind is to eliminate Christianity at all from any vestige or part. And little by little by little, you know, they attack these institutions that have any basis in Christianity or belief in God at all. The origin of what they're all talking about was actually a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1802 to a Baptist group who were fearful that the new Federalist government might interfere in their belief system and would be a threat to their religion. Thomas Jefferson reassured them, but he used a phrase that was given in an earlier century by a Baptist minister by the name of Roger Williams. In Roger Williams' sermon, he described the church as a garden, a beautifully tended garden. And it was separated from and protected from the state. And that all the individuals, a part of that church within that garden, would be protected by this great stone wall that kept the state. And when you think about where our forefathers came from, in which people were hung for their beliefs, and many great theologians who bucked the king of England and the Church of England were either hung or they were tortured, and eventually a lot of them were able to leave and escape. Seventh-day Baptists were some of them, and we trace some of our historical ancestry back to some of those folks that landed in the new world. William's sermon describes the church as a well-kept garden. It was protected from man's government by a wall that God erected. And he contended that from time to time, God allowed that wall of separation for the purpose of disciplining the church. Now, I think he was not really accurate there, but the drafters of the Constitution never intended, and Thomas Jefferson never intended, for religion or any reference to God to be excluded from our government or our schools. Jefferson just used a phrase to assure us and the Baptists that the church would be protected from the state. Not that the state would be protected from religion, and that's what the issue is today. People want the state to be protected from this horrible religion called Christianity. That's their fear. That's the greatest fear they have. Russia? No worries there. You know, the ISIS? No problem. What we really have to fear are all these church people. All these church people who believe in God. The Constitution does not mention a wall of separation, yet people who have no idea what the first article of the Bill of Rights actually says are intimately familiar with separation of church and state. Oh, my. We were founded as a Christian, not a godless nation. I don't care what our president said in Turkey a few years ago, that we're no longer a Christian nation. Well, maybe we're not. Maybe he's right. Maybe that's why what is coming is coming, because we have departed so far from God. It's oftentimes illegal to post the Ten Commandments in a public building. Prayers in schools, graduation ceremonies are outlawed because mention of God could come about. There was even one one young man or a woman who mentioned God in his valedictorian speech at a high school that was sued by somebody. It's just unbelievable. A federal court ruled a school teacher couldn't be seen in school with his Bible. Unbelievable. Going back to 1947, the Supreme Court case, Everson versus the Board of Education, Judge Hugo Black asserted that the Constitution erected a wall of separation between church and state. He didn't look to the Constitution for his majority opinion, though. He looked to this citation that I've given about Thomas Jefferson's letter, and it had nothing to do with the Constitution. Finally, former Justice William Rehnquist wisely said that the principle of separation of church and state is bad history. It didn't exist, and it doesn't exist, and it's even worse law. 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 18. Man, you know, even the people who want freedom from God and want to cast off restraint, they don't want any church, they don't want any religion, they don't want any law telling them what to do. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 18, it says, "For when they speak great swelling words of emptiness, they allure through the lust of the flesh through lewdness the ones who have actually escaped from those who live in error. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption, for by whom a person is overcome by him, also he is brought into bondage." We are reaping ever so slowly in our society the nutty ideas that have sprung from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. When the knowledge of God is cast away, we are sentencing ourselves to learning what doesn't work the hard way. Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 17. By now you know, of course, that Leviticus is one of the cursings chapter. And, you know, I'm not sure if I've just missed this, and I'm not sure that it really has any great significance, any greater over what I've always supposed. Because I always thought that this particular verse was applicable to a time in which we would be ruled by foreign bodies and not ourselves. But I'm wondering, you know, out loud, and I'm not saying it's not a teaching of the church or any doctrine or anything, but God says that he will bless his people for obedience and they will be cursed for disobedience if they disregard him. In verse 17, this is definitely a curse. "I will set my face against you and you shall be defeated by your enemies." And that has happened. And we allow it to happen with impunity now. I mean, we're just giving away the store in modern times. I mean, I like the advertisement. You may have seen it on the radio for Marco Rubio, who talks about the various changes that we have had with Iran. You know, first, we're going to limit, you know, you can only have so many centrifuges and you can produce the nuclear fuel. And then we amended that. Well, okay, now you can have 10,000 of them and you can sell it. He says, if we go on another 5 years, we're going to be building the bomb for Iran. Says, we're going to be giving it to them. You know, we're just allowing this to happen. "Those who hate you shall reign over you." Those who hate you shall reign over you. I'm not so sure that it doesn't apply today. Because the American experience of individualism and freedom and a belief in God is certainly under attack today. And it doesn't necessarily mean all the rulers, but it's certainly a prospect, something to consider. Now we come to Donald Trump's statement. Oh, that horrible man. That horrible, flamboyant, nine-billionaire real estate investor who had the audacity to run for president, had the audacity to what? Tell the truth. What did he say? That he is, you know, you would have thought that Donald Trump has implicated every single Mexican citizen and called each one of them a murderer and a rapist. I mean, by the reaction and what people say he said, I mean, it's kind of crazy. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. I'm trying to find out where he's missed the mark on that. People do not like it when people are told the truth. Isaiah 5:20 says, "Woe to those who call good evil and evil good." One of the profundities of the United States government has been the clear distinction and separation of power between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, which was an object of the Federalist Papers from the time of the Declaration of Independence till the final establishment of the Constitution of the United States. And it was clear that they began to understand and write that there must be co-equal branches of government that would check and balance one another. We don't have that distinction any longer, and maybe we haven't for some time. People are once again being governed against their will by almost a supreme monarchy, because all three branches basically agree with one another. And that's kind of a key point, I think, in evaluating where we are in history and in prophecy. How do most people react to what's going on? I'm not a poll taker. I can't tell you. I just know that I think there's a lot of upheaval in our society and a lot of kind of rebellion against some of these things that are happening in the changing mores in our society. I will say this. Again, in closing, the largest demographic is becoming the young people ages 34 and below, and they'll get older, and they, you know, we will die away, all of us, maybe before Christ returns. But they are more concerned as a group. Obviously, there are differences. They're more concerned with equality and fairness. And so some of the radical things that you think are radical that are decreed by these judges are nothing more than fair game to people that have not been taught in a society that appreciates the law of God, or a society that understands that you cannot have freedom without the enforcement of law. So how long before the prophecies of Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 34 become a reality? We don't know. But let's turn, in closing, to Hosea chapter 14. Hosea chapter 14. Because the good news is that eventually this all gets turned around. O Israel, return to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take words with you and return to the Lord. Say to him, take away all iniquity, receive us graciously, for we will offer the sacrifices of our lips. Assyria shall not save us. We will not ride on horses, nor will we say any more to the work of our hands, you are our gods, for in you the fatherless finds mercy. God says, I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for my anger is turned away from them. I shall be like the dew to Israel. He shall grow like the lily and lengthen his roots like Lebanon. His branches shall spread. His beauty shall be like an olive tree and his fragrance like Lebanon. Those who dwell under his shadow shall return. They shall be revived like grain and shall grow like a vine. Their scent shall be like the wine of Lebanon. Ephraim shall say, what have I to do any more with idols? I have heard and observed him. I am like a green cypress tree. Your fruit is found in me. Who is wise? Let him understand these things. Who is prudent? Let him know them. Think this is a message to us, to you. For the ways of the Lord are right. The righteous walk in them, but transgressors stumble in them. The way to real freedom and liberty is within the law of God and walking in it. Brethren, let us pray that we can be that voice that will sigh and cry for the abominations that beset modern-day Israel, so that freedom, real freedom, will be available to all men.